Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are modern humans the only humans? It seems an odd question now, but there was a time in history when modern humans and Neanderthals roamed simultaneously. They certainly looked different from one another and may have had different physiological advantages and disadvantages. But were they really so different culturally and mentally? And why did modern humans live on while Neanderthals vanished an estimated 28,000 years ago? Jamie Shreve is science editor for National Geographic magazine, which features an October cover story called The Other Humans, Neanderthals Revealed. Jamie, welcome to Think.
It's good to be on your show, Chris.
How did we first become aware that they had existed in the first place?
Well, it was in 1856 in a quarry in Germany, in the Neander Valley of Germany. Some quarrymen were sort of chucking bones down the side of a ravine, someone at the bottom of the ravine recognized one of them as possibly looking like some kind of extinct cave bear. Turned out to be not a cave bear, but an extinct form of human being. And that was the first Neanderthal man, and that's why we call it that, because Tal in German means valley, so that's from the Neander Valley.
And what did they look like as compared with, maybe not people today, but modern humans of the time?
Well, they were very robust. They were very powerfully built individuals. I use a book I wrote about 10 years ago called The Neanderthal Enigma. I use the example of a Neanderthal could take a NFL linebacker and throw him over the goalposts. They had immense strength. They had certain peculiar features of their face, very large projecting front mid-faces and big noses. They had heavy brow ridges, which is something that everybody kind of identifies with Neanderthals, but they're actually just a primitive trait in a lot of other extinct kinds of human ancestors. That was their major characteristic, so just this big squat body that was really built for thermoregulation, for retaining heat in very cold glacial climates.
Yeah, they were sort of fire plug shaped.
Yes, that's a good example. That's a good metaphor.
And you say that a Neanderthal man could throw a linebacker over the goalpost. It sounds like a Neanderthal woman could do the same thing.
That's a good question. You know, we have a lot of bones, and you don't always know which one is a female bone and which one is a male bone. So you need to find particular characteristics which are uniquely female to know that. And there's only really one female pelvis known of a Neanderthal from a place called Tabun in Israel. And from what we know about females, they were remarkably robust, not as robust as the males, however.
And they had to have a huge amount of calories every day. What did they eat?
The classical Neanderthal diet in the sort of real homeland of the Neanderthals that we think of as being Western Europe was a lot of meat, a lot of big bovids, big animals, big mammals that they killed. And this was a diet that was, you know, tremendously caloric. I mean, they needed a lot of calories, and that's how they got them. They estimate that a Neanderthal, based on its body size and shape, would need about 5,000 calories a day to keep alive.
So they needed all that fuel, and occasionally, or at least at times, women and even children may have participated in hunting right alongside the men.
Well, that's a relatively new idea, and it was proposed by a couple of archaeologists named Mary Steiner and Steve Kuhn. It's we make a big deal in modern human life ways about the division of labor that we have between in sort of classic modern hunter-gatherer, the men hunt and the women gather. Those are a lot of crossover, but there is this sort of sense that there is a division of labor, and the women's activities are focused around having to also care for the children, keep them safe. We don't seem to see the archaeological evidence of that. At least Steiner and Kuhn do not see the archaeological evidence of that division of labor in the classic Neanderthals of Western Europe, which would suggest that the females were participating in the hunt with the men. They may not have been up close to a mammoth or as gouging it with a spear, but they were cutting off escape routes or somehow maybe hurting the prey or helping out in other ways. But in any case, they were putting themselves pretty close to danger doing that. And that may have been a sort of tipping point when this kind of $60,000 question that everybody wants to know is, why did they go extinct? And maybe this sort of limitation on their child, on the number of children that they could raise safely to reproductive age, might have had something to do with it.
So they weren't in a place that was safe, and they weren't able to sort of keep an eye on the children if they were out there having to participate in the hunting.
So the kids are kind of running underfoot, and the herd takes a sudden turn and turns in the direction of the women who are trying to cut off the escape route, and they go, you know, running madly away, and the kids get lost in the shuffle, and some of them never come out. You know, these are scenarios and sort of tales that we tell the best we can, or that the scientists tell the best they can from the limited evidence that exists, but it's a very plausible one.
Is there any evidence, Jamie, that men may have also taken on what we think of as more female gender jobs?
And back then there weren't that many jobs to do. There was, you know, there weren't many
secretaries
or you know, teachers or things that we would traditionally think of as female jobs. There was getting food and making the fire and keeping warm and keeping safe and keeping predators away. And I would imagine, I need to make your listeners aware that I'm not a scientist. I'm a science writer, and so I can't speak from deep knowledge about this. But I would imagine that a lot of these activities were shared according to what was needed at the time and who was at the place that where a job needed to be done.
Jamie Shreve is my guest. He is science editor of National Geographic magazine, which has an October issue cover story called Last of the Neanderthals. It's sort of named differently depending on where you find it in the magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. How many Neanderthals were there on Earth at any one time?
Well, that's, again, it's difficult to make those kinds of calculations, but we do know that there were remarkably few. I think there's one calculation that was no more than, say, 15,000 spread over the entire European continent at their high point. So you can see the population density was not very great. But then at the same time, the modern humans who at that time were living in Africa may not have had very dense populations either.
So they were...
It just wasn't a world that was so human-centric as it is today, by any means.
They've been discovered, remains have been discovered in Europe and up into Asia. Is there any evidence that they may have existed anywhere else on the planet?
Their range was large, but it was confined to Eurasia and the Middle East. I think as far north as Britain and into southern Siberia. There was recently a find, actually it was a recalculation of a find from well east into Siberia, to the west into the Iberian Peninsula and south into Israel and Syria and Iraq. But there's no evidence of a classic Neanderthal type outside of that area. And it's an interesting phenomenon because, of course, there were other kinds of humans alive at the same time in Africa and further east in Asia. And in, even down into Australia, there were a species called Homo erectus that was everywhere else. And then in Africa, these things were evolving into modern people.
They came from a common ancestor with modern humans today. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did they start to split off and I guess, evolve different characteristics physically?
Well, these things are really hard to tell answering just with bones. And that's why the introduction of genetics into the science of paleoanthropology has been such a huge, dramatic change and refreshing new light that's shed on these questions in the last 10 or 15 years or so. It looks, according to the genetic evidence, especially that they diverged in Africa, the ancestors of Neanderthals and the ancestors of modern humans started diverging at about 700,000 years ago. So they go way back together. And then at a certain point, the ancestors of Neanderthals left Africa, went out, populated Eurasia, developed into these classic Neanderthal features, and were living there for as Neanderthals for some 200,000, 250,000 years before the modern humans, who had been evolving at the same time in Africa, had their own exodus out of Africa, only to find that the continent of Eurasia was already occupied by another species. And that's where the fun sort of begins in these questions. What happened to one, and why did one go on to become us and the other vanish from the record?
Yeah, you were talking about DNA evidence. Where does the DNA come from when you find a specimen? Can you take that from a bone?
That's where they get them. To me, this is a fantastic piece of science that we can now extract tiny fragment of DNA from a bone that's 40,000 years old and purify that DNA, isolate the sequence, and begin to actually stitch back together the entire genetic code of an extinct human species. This is something to me that's just, it still gives me chills to think about that they're doing this. But the one of the first bones that they used for this initial work, which was in the late 90s, was that original Neanderthal man from the Neander Valley. That's the bone they started with. And then there's been some others from Eastern Europe.
How much tissue does it require to get a sample that's going to work?
It's not the amount of tissue. It's really the real danger is contamination, mm-hmm. because it's so easy for humans who are handling these bones to leave tiny traces of their own DNA behind. Not just the scientists that are doing the DNA work, but all the scientists who have examined these bones over decades have left a little bit of themselves behind. And so they have to make sure that the sample that they're taking from well inside the bone has no contact with any contaminant from modern DNA on the outside, because it's unlike, say, sequencing a zebra or sequencing even a chimpanzee. The DNA of the Neanderthals and the modern humans is so close, it's very easy to make mistakes.
So has the entire genome of Neanderthal man been and woman been identified and mapped out?
I think they're getting very close. We actually tried to time the publication of the article to the announcement of the completion of the genetic code of the Neanderthals, but it's very hard to do that, you know, months or years in advance. And I think we should be having an announcement soon from a laboratory in Leipzig that's doing the primary work within probably, I'd say, 3 to 6 months.
And all indications are they are 99% equal to modern humans?
Oh, much, much closer than 99%. I think, I don't know what the latest figures are, but we're probably 99% or close with a chimp. I think with Neanderthals, we're probably more like 99.89% or something. It's very close, as you would expect, because these were our last common ancestors. So we would expect, if evolution is in fact occurring the way that it seems to be occurring in all other species, we would expect our closest ancestors to be very close to us genetically as well.
So is the most current thinking that they are a subspecies of humans, or that they are a separate species of humans?
That was a huge debate for a long time, for most of the time that we've had Neanderthals around since 1856. So the question is whether they were the immediate ancestors of modern Europeans alone, so are they sort of evolved regionally into their present-day people in Europe, while at the same time other things were evolving into present-day Asians and present-day Africans. That species, that theory was called multi-regional continuity. The other idea, and if that was the case, then they would probably call them a subspecies. They would be Homo sapiens Neanderthalis. The other idea is the one I was describing earlier, that the modern humans all come from Africa and came out of Africa fairly recently, more like 60,000 years ago, encountered these Neanderthals and Homo erectus and whatever else was outside of Africa at the time, and basically displaced them.
Let me stop you right there, Jamie. We have to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute with Jamie Shreve, who is science editor of National Geographic magazine.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jamie Shreve. He wrote a book called The Neanderthal Enigma, Solving the Mystery of Modern Human Origins. He is also the science editor of National Geographic magazine, which has a cover story on Neanderthals in its October issue. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think at kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So you were concluding before, Jamie, you said this second theory about what happened is that modern humans and other kinds of humans evolved at around the same time and essentially displaced other kinds of humans, including the Neanderthals.
Right. This would be the what's called the out-of-Africa theory. And it was, again, widely supported by the genetics that came around, that modern humans came out of Africa, and however, either, you know, by some kind of physical confrontation or just by attrition or in some ways replaced the Neanderthals. And that would suggest, I should mention, and without necessarily, it could have been interbreeding, but that there's no sign of that interbreeding left in the modern, the DNA of modern people. So maybe the children of those offspring of those matings happened were not viable themselves, or who knows, but we don't seem to see much evidence that there was significant interbreeding between them, which would suggest that they are were indeed a separate species, another kind of human. And I find that particularly resonant because they were so much like us. They had big brains like us. They had the same sort of culture as the modern humans at the time, with some slight differences like the one I mentioned earlier of this difference in division of labor. So it's a big mystery why one kind of human vanishes and the other continues. But what really just always sort of gets me about the Neanderthals is they were so much like us, and they're gone.
Yeah, it's chilling to think that it could just as easily have gone the other way.
Yes and no. Yeah, I mean, there must have been something. Evolution is not arbitrary. Adaptations are, you know, they're not like maybe this, maybe that. It's something worked that the ancestors of modern humans were doing that didn't work for Neanderthals and would not have worked clearly because it didn't. If they had had something that we had, they probably would have still been around. It's just a question of what.
We have an email from Cal who says, there seems to be evidence of human Neanderthal hybrids in the fossil record. However, the human genome has no Neanderthal genes. If they were hybrids, wouldn't they have been sterile, which would explain the conundrum? I guess he's thinking about, you know, a mule, sort of the same situation?
Yes, yes. There is some evidence. Some researchers believe there's evidence of hybridization from some fossils in Portugal and some other ones in Romania. And longer ago, some people thought some in Israel. Some of this is in the eye of the beholder, and I know that some of the scientists doing that work, and they're very, very good scientists. But it's certainly not a consensus view that those fossils are hybrids. And if they were, then I can't say your listener, but your emailer might be correct that there was some hybridization going on. But the hybrids themselves, or the children of the hybrids, were not as viable as the modern human lineage.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey, you know, your guest had talked about the fact that we have all but gotten rid of the Neanderthal genome. I've got an uncle that I think might debunk that, but I think maybe we might all have that. But
yeah.
My question is, it kind of results leads to this idea of, you know, the more and more scientific information that we get that's validated in terms of this link that exists between us and the Neanderthals, it seems to, depending on again the eye of the beholder, challenge the idea that really strict creationists have. So my question is what are your experiences in whether you've ever had a debate session with someone who is a strict creationist or any of your dealings with this idea of this link that exists and this evidence that continues to mount versus, you know, someone who has these very strict creationist approaches to how we came about?
Well, I haven't had a formal debate, but I've had a number of people on call-in shows such as this who are are creationists who asked me about this and challenged this point of view. I have to first of all say, you know, I respect everybody's faith and their right to believe in anything they want in that regard. I just totally believe in science. I believe that if we ask the right questions and ask them correctly, it's the best way to get closer and closer to the truth. I think a lot of people mistake science for an endeavor that sort of knows what's happening, and there's sort of this sort of elitist idea that scientists think they know everything. Well, that's not what they do. What they do is ask questions that get closer and closer to the possibility of truth. And so far, in the fossil record for humankind, you will see a very clear progression of the fossils from very primitive things like Lucy, afarensis, to less primitive things, Homo habilis, Homo erectus. And as you go further and further in time, you get things that look more and more like us. And if we were to find a fossil of a modern human in the fossil record 2 million years ago, that would refute everything that scientists have been saying about human evolution, if it were in fact, if it was not a dating problem or something. Because modern humans weren't around then. And if we found it then, we'd have to rethink the whole thing. But what a scientist would say is, okay, let's rethink this. I think what a creationist tends to do is, well, let's not think about it. You know, let's just take on faith, by definition, what we believe to be true, and not worry what is really happening out there in the evidence, or try to challenge that evidence in ways which is really kind of making little picky points. You know, evolutionists don't always agree about how evolution happens, so therefore it's just a theory, et cetera. It's really a mistaken interpretation of how science works. Again, I respect people's faith, but I like to look at what the world is all about, and I would believe in a creator who would want me to be doing that.
Jamie Shreve is my guest. He is science editor of National Geographic magazine. It's really interesting to read in the piece how DNA has given clues as to whether or not Neanderthals could speak.
This is one of the most fascinating developments in evolution right now for me, is that we're getting this DNA from Neanderthals, and we can look at their genes, and some of these genes are beginning to show actual possible hints at their behavior. That the one you mentioned in particular is a gene called FOXP2. Now, we don't know that that's the gene that makes language happen, but we do know that in certain modern humans in which this gene is mutated, those people who have that mutation are not able to talk. They're otherwise normal, but they cannot form normal sentences. We also know that if you change this gene in mice, that their voices change. I mean, not they don't have voices, but there's all kinds. Yeah, they're the vocalizations. We know it has something to do with brain and language and with the physical ability to speak. So we look at Neanderthals, and lo and behold, we find the same gene in the same form as modern humans. So it gives support to the notion that Neanderthals had themselves developed language, and that's a huge piece of information. I mean, that just tells a whole lot. It doesn't mean necessarily that they did, but it sure gives us a really big hint, and it makes it harder for those arguing that they didn't have language to support that argument. So this is something that I find really just really exciting, and as this genome of the Neanderthals is worked on and finished, we're going to find more and more of those genes that give hints at the behavior.
Did they leave behind any possessions beyond clothing and tools and practical necessities?
Well, there's some evidence that they left behind fragments of pigment that they were probably using to paint their bodies or paint rocks or something like that, some sort of beginnings of an idea of a sort of symbol, a mind that could embrace symbols and understand the world symbolically. There is some evidence of burials, though it's not as strong as some people think. There was a very classic Neanderthal burial in Iraq for a long time, believed to be covered with flowers, and it turns out that those flowers were probably just pollen that was blown into the cave. So we don't really know for sure that they were burying their dead, but I suspect that they were, and that they had a very deep symbolic life. But we have some evidence of sort of little pierced little trinkets and stuff, but it's not a lot. But it does show that they were capable of doing that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Southlake and talk to Leslie. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering whether there's a way to determine if the modern man who emerged out of Africa, when encountering the Neanderthals, communicated to them diseases which the Neanderthals couldn't sustain, just as when the Europeans came to North America, they decimated areas.
It's quite possible. It's a very plausible idea. I don't know myself how you would test that, how you would go out and figure that out. But you might be able to, if there's some kind of pathology that leaves a record in the bones, you could see that. But what we do see in Neanderthals is a lot of evidence of their bones. They had a very hard lives. There are a lot of injuries. But there's some arthritic evidence of arthritis and other diseases like that, joint diseases. But I'm not aware of how you would tell that, though it's a fascinating idea.
How long did it take them to go from birth to adult stature and mental capacity?
Well, there's some controversy about that too. A lot of things. In the article in this month's National Geographic. We demonstrate some evidence, or we just talk about some evidence showing that the Neanderthals may have matured faster than modern humans. And this is important because if you're maturing faster, that means you have less time to be hanging around the adults and the group and learning skills and communicating, more with a larger social group. So there's some evidence possibly that that they had less of that going on, and they reached adulthood quicker. Their lives were nasty, brutal, and short, as the saying is. I think the average lifespan was probably somewhere in the early 30s. But that, at the same time, I'm not sure what the modern human lifespan back then was either. But this idea that they were maturing quicker is not something that's universally accepted. And since we came out with that article, there's another paper been published that suggests the other side. So, these are questions that are really up in the air and widely debated and just totally fascinating to me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the cover story in this month's National Geographic magazine with its science editor, Jamie Shreve. Let's go next to Beverly in Benbrook. Hello, Beverly.
Hello. I was curious as to whether there's any evidence of direct physical conflict, like over hunting grounds, for example, between our closer ancestors and the Neanderthals. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
That's another good question. There's certainly evidence of violence in the Neanderthal record. The problem is you can't tell who's doing the violence to the victims. We have the victims. We have, for instance, there's one site. There's one site in Spain that we talk about quite a lot in the article, where the predominant number of individuals in this one sort of collection of bones were cannibalized. These are Neanderthals. Now we don't really know why they were cannibalized, and we certainly don't know who they were who was doing the eating. But it was at a time when modern humans would have been coming into Spain, so you could at least sort of imagine there might have been some kind of conflict going on there. But it's not supported really by anything you could point to. It's not that if you found a Neanderthal skeleton with a typical modern human projectile point sort of poking into its ribs, that would be really cool. I mean, you do see that in the Iceman much later in time. This body that was found in the Alps, there was a arrowhead in his shoulder. It was in a particular position that would have cut his carotid artery and killed him. So that man was murdered, basically. But we don't have that sort of fine detail way back in time with the Neanderthals.
You mentioned that Neanderthals had fire. Did they use the same technology that modern humans did, flint and steel?
No steel, but the modern humans then didn't have it either, but certainly flint. They were probably starting fires with the same techniques that you'd see in hunter-gatherers that are still in Stone Age recently.
So is the assumption that everyone sort of figured this out separately as opposed to learning it from someone else?
Well, they would have probably, the fire is in the fossil record. Gosh, I'd have to go back into my memory banks. I can't remember where you start first seeing evidence of hearths, but probably 200,000 years ago or so, you see evidence of hearths. Now, whether they're cooking meat with it, or, I'm not sure. You know, it could have been keeping warm, keeping predators away at night.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we speak to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw a program on, I think, on a History Channel about Neanderthals a long time ago, but they didn't mention the common ancestor. And you did, which gets me to my question, which is once in evolution, once species branch off from a common ancestor, do they ever merge back together and become indistinguishable? You probably know a lot more examples of mammals with common ancestors than I do, but I know a few, and they just don't seem to ever go back together and merge.
That's a really good question, and something I'm just always been interested in. As I understand it, and again, I'm a layperson like yourself. I'm a science writer, but I've looked at this question a little bit. You once species start to separate, and what that is usually, though not always, done in isolation. The one population of a species will become geographically isolated in some way. In the case of Neanderthals, by just the barrier of the Middle East, sort of a little bottleneck there. There wasn't much room for people to go back and forth. So once they're isolated and start to evolve traits that are different, they are going to reach a point where they are reproductively incompatible with the parent species. However, there'll be what's called hybrid zones in between these two, where you've got these sort of transitional types, populations, which could go one way or the other. You see that in baboons in Ethiopia, the particular kind of baboon.
Let's take a break right here, Jamie.
Sure.
We'll be back in just a minute with Jamie Shreve.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly. A part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Science editor Jamie Shreve is here from National Geographic magazine. In its October cover story, it talks about Neanderthals. The piece is called The Other Humans, Neanderthals Revealed. If you want to join our discussion, you can call 800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Jamie, you were talking about the fact that essentially there are these hybrid zones where species that have begun to evolve away from other members of that species can, in fact, reproduce in those small areas.
That's right. And you see this in modern species today. I was mentioning the baboons. There's lots of other examples. But once you get complete reproductive isolation from the ancestral species to the daughter species, that's it. There ain't no going back and becoming one species again. You'd have to invent some new kind of evolution.
Let's go next to Denton and speak to Shrimi Bassam. Hi, Shrimi Bassam.
Hi. Thank you very much. Very interesting conversation. And I really appreciate the speaker clarifying about creationism. As a scientist, I think we can't say that enough for how science and faith differs. That's my comment. And my question is, but did the Neanderthals have various racial categories like we modern humans do? Thank you.
Thanks for your
call. Good question. I don't know if the fossil record is deep enough, if there's enough information to start to see whether you can see this is a racial type from southwestern France, and this one further east has a whole different physiognomy that you could call a race. What you do see is evidence of progression in time, where a kind of more amorphous sort of quasi-vaguely Neanderthal earlier ancestor becomes more and more, develops these classic Neanderthal features. But I'm not aware of anyone suggesting that there is a very clear distinction between different geographical regions of Neanderthals.
There is some evidence that at least a number of them had red hair and freckles.
Well, that's part of the new thing. This genetic evidence, and this is where things get really exciting, and why we wanted to do an article in National Geographic about this. In addition to that gene for possible language ability, they've also isolated a gene that codes in modern humans for red hair and pale skin. So we don't know that all Neanderthals were pale-skinned and red-haired, but we certainly know that some of them were. And this enabled us at the magazine to develop the first reconstruction of a full-bodied Neanderthal based not just on fossil but on genetic evidence as well, which is a very exciting project for us. We developed a Neanderthal female, which we incorporated a lot of evidence from the fossil record, but also gave her red hair and pale skin because we know that now from the genetic record.
What went into deciding to make it a woman? Because that seems like an unusual choice. For whatever reason, it's always the man that is the prototype.
Well, that's one of the reasons. You know, it's always the man. And we thought it would be much more interesting to see evoke a Neanderthal female in light of some of the archaeological work, for instance. The one I mentioned earlier of Steiner and Kuhn's work sort of focused on the female and what the female was doing. And this idea that females were hunters as well, we thought was pretty cool. So we wanted to create a Neanderthal woman who was fierce and independent and strong and express that physically, embody that in this model. And we got a couple of fantastic paleo artists, the Kennis brothers from the Netherlands, to work on this model. They spent months on it, incorporating all the latest scientific information, but as well coming up with bringing something to life. This model, as you see on the cover of the magazine and in the pages of the magazine, has enormous sort of resonance and vigor that you don't usually see in these plasticine models.
Yeah, it's indistinguishable from a photograph of a living being when you look at it, especially on the cover.
Yeah, it is. They have remarkable facial detail, little crags and crooks and little flaws of the face that you see. You would see in somebody who's lived a pretty tough life but is still living it to the hilt.
Rode hard and put up wet, we say in Texas.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jim in Boyd. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Jim.
Howdy. Hey, I had a question. And number one, I'd like to say that it's just amazing what we're finding out today from the genetic work that everybody's doing and the breakthroughs. And my question is it possible that you could take a strand from the Neanderthal DNA and human embryo, kind of like we do with the designer baby type concept, and impart some of the characteristics of the Neanderthal into a modern-day human?
Now, don't think that way. You're going into a dangerous place there, Jim. But just kidding.
Ethically, you mean?
Yes, ethically. There is, in fact, you could say, just theoretically, if we finish the genetic code of a Neanderthal, and if we developed the technology to be able to translate that code into a living cell, we could do the same sort of experiment that was done with Dolly the sheep. You could clone a Neanderthal, or you could implant a Neanderthal in a human egg and have a human give birth to this. You can see the ethical issues there are insurmountable, but the idea is fascinating, and perhaps they'll be able to do this kind of work with other extinct species where the ethical issues are not so supreme. For instance, mammoths. They're getting DNA out of mammoths quite regularly. We're a long way from being able to clone a mammoth, but not that far. You know, it's not something that couldn't possibly happen in my lifetime, and I'm well into my 50s. So we're living in an exciting time.
It's funny. It's an interesting question. It is horrifying. You know, as I read the piece, I kept thinking, it's a lucky thing that there is only one kind of human, because we've had enough problems as it is with race, let alone having a separate species of human being.
Yeah, you can imagine how they would be treated by your typical modern human today. I mean, if we judge people on being different from ourselves, they are way different. I don't know. It does. Yeah, it's sort of a statement. I had this notion in my book of book opened with this sort of gathering of people in a cafe in France, and everybody's Algerian, French, American tourists, Japanese. I just saw the scene. Everybody was together, and the scientist who was with me had with him a Neanderthal jaw, which he laid out on the table, and it just struck me that this different is all we think ourselves to be. In our geographical distributions and racial types, if you want to use that term, we are all very much the same compared to a Neanderthal, and we're very much the same with them as compared with the next out group, with the chimpanzees.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Walt in Dallas. Hey, Walt.
Hello. Very fascinating program, and Jamie, I really appreciate your insights. I have a question to you regarding regressive evolution. I understand that some genes are either switched on or off, and that's what basically differentiates these things, and we tend to think that everything always goes in a forward fashion. But yet in my lifetime, I had a neighbor who was born with webbed fingers and toes. I've heard of it's not uncommon for humans to be born with prehensile tails, which are usually surgically removed at birth. And 30 years ago, when I was in the jungles of Costa Rica in the Peace Corps, I saw a person that did not look, having studied anthropology, looked more like a Neanderthal than a human. And I would just like to hear your perspective on whether regressive evolution or development of genes is possible, basically gene switching back. And I'll take the answer off here.
As far as I understand it, well, it's more a question of, we have a developmental pattern that we go through. There's a timing of when genes are turned on and turned off as we develop from an embryo into a fetus and into a child and so forth. And this timing is really very much the same I should correct myself. The genes are very much the same in one mammal to another, and in fact, even across the animal kingdom. And what's different is the timing of this pattern of development, of when they're switched on and switched off. So you might have a situation where there's a genetic flaw in the timing of a gene being turned on that would produce some kind of primitive trait. It's just that developmental record is something shared with things that are, much different than us. So it sort of produces something that looks like something more primitive. It's really just, it's a modern human with maybe one little genetic little switch that didn't get turned on right. As for an entire creature that looks Neanderthalish or, apish in some way, there's certain pathologies that might mimic such a thing. I don't think there's any kind of sense that the entire genetic code can sort of start to make a U-turn and by accident and regress through the whole body plan like that.
Let's go next to Nancy in Dallas. Hello, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There was a report recently that they found another human species that was really small in stature, but there's a discussion in the community of whether it's actually a different species or whether they were just diseased. Do you know about the bones that they discovered somewhere in the islands in the Pacific?
Yes, that's a species called Homo florenciensis. It's absolutely incredible. This find was in 2004. This species is very small. It's like 3 feet tall. I should say this find. We're not quite sure about the species. And it's only 18,000 years old, which is just a blink of the eye in evolutionary time. 18,000 years old, Plato was around the corner at that age. This is a very recent fossil that has very primitive traits. So how do you explain that? One explanation of the people that believe that it is a separate species is this is a population that got isolated on the island of Flores in Indonesia, And just if you don't have contact, just like one of the other callers was talking about, you know, speciation, if it's you get isolated, you go your own direction, that's it. You can't go back. And it another side of this that believes that this is just too incredible to believe, so it must be some sort of pathology. It's a modern human, not modern like current human, but a 18,000-year-old Homo sapiens that is diseased, that had a little tiny brain because it was microcephalic for some pathological reason. This debate has been going back and forth. It's very heated in the paleoanthropological community. I think it's. I don't believe that the disease guys are gonna win this one. But at least it throws you back into this mystery of how this little tiny species could exist for so long while the rest of the planet had been populated by modern humans. I'm sorry, not the Americas at that point, but soon after. So it's a fascinating fossil and something we featured in the magazine a few years ago, and I think we should revisit.
We have time for one more quick call from Stephen in Denton. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, I had a question for your guest about whether they had done or looked at any of the mitochondrial DNA evidence to see if there was any descendants in modern day from Neanderthals.
Good question. They actually, the complete Neanderthal mitochondrial genome was finished just this past summer. For your listeners who aren't familiar with that term, it's a kind of DNA that's outside of the nucleus of the cell, performs sort of some energy-related activities, but it's a little circle of DNA that's easier to sequence, and for other reasons, it's a good thing to look at for scientists. And they have sequenced that in Neanderthals, and they've found that, you know, every study so far seems to conclude that it's outside the range of modern human mitochondrial DNA, sort of confirming them as a separate species. In fact, there's been a recent publication showing that even modern humans that back then, what we call Cro-Magnons in Europe, also had modern human mitochondrial DNA, very different from the Neanderthals they were living side by side with. Really interesting work.
Can you briefly share your favorite unanswered question, Jamie?
Oh, it's still got to be, why did they go extinct? Why aren't they around? They had everything going for them. They had big brains. They were well adapted to their glacial environment. They'd been there 250,000 years, much longer than we've been on the planet. Then they just vanished. There's a lot of possible suggestions of why, and I think what is coming down to is people realizing that there may not be one answer to such a profound question. It may be that climatic evidence shows that maybe they couldn't respond to some quick changes in climate in one place, in another place maybe it was the modern humans had better tools and drove them out. It's a sort of mosaic of possibilities, but it's an ongoing question and one I find just really cool.
You can read about some of the ideas in National Geographic magazine this month. Jamie Shreve is science editor. Thank you so much, Jamie, for being with us this
hour. Thanks for having me on your show, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.